Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. I am your host, Wade Bojic, joined by David Ishida.
Hello, everybody.
And just the best Ben Robertson you can imagine.
Greetings.
Of all the many Ben Robertsons.
The late great.
The late great Ben Robertsons join us, raised from the dead. So I have had so much fun talking indie gear, indie tricks and methods of filmmaking, and also the movies we've gone to see. This episode, we're going to have a blast talking about, first of all, a subject that gets overlooked a lot, tripods.
Yes.
Very important thing.
Absolutely.
And then following in Tools of the Trade, we've got a lot to talk about in regards to gear protection, sort of maintenance a little bit, but more...
Mainly protection.
More protection and like talking about how important it is to have durable equipment. Mm-hmm. We'll include some of our own personal stories and stuff we've bought and horror stories there and recommend some of the things you can invest in that really make the difference in your film experience. And then finally, this month, we saw Fences by Denzel Washington and also starring Denzel Washington, which I'm really glad that it was still in theaters for us to see. I think it came out in December.
Yeah, I think it was eked in right before the Oscar deadline.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So we're going to be talking about that at the tail end of the episode. But first and foremost, starting off, I think my first experience with a tripod was my mom's really old metallic tripod. It was made like of thick aluminum.
You know,
very 80s.
Did it have the twist lock?
Yeah, it had the twist lock.
That's the same with my dad's, which was a photo tripod.
Yep.
There was no quick release plate. You spun the camera to get it on, and then you had to like loosen the knobs to do pan and tilt.
And you can tell it's a photo tripod because it's like a weird tilt plate. Like the plate itself that the camera's on can tilt sideways for portrait and landscape.
Yep.
And I mean, it makes sense from a photography perspective, but it's a pain in the ass when you're shooting video.
Yeah, well, one of the early things I learned in when I first did some, I'll say for lack of a better, proper filmmaking in high school, the biggest thing I loved about the tripod I used in high school was that it had a fluid head.
Mm. Does that mean you can loosen it and set the angle, like the horizon line?
No, the fluid head is where there's the pan. Some cameras, it's only one or the other, but like on this one, it was on the tilt. There is fluid that's actually around in on the head, which makes for smoother spinning.
Oh, sure.
Is it like an oil or is it really
yeah,
fluid?
No, like it's like an oil or something.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the dumb thing about the old photo tripods that have that plate that can tilt for portrait mode is that the lock mechanism wears out eventually, and then you set the camera on and then it just automatically sags a little bit, and it's
because of the weight and just kind of goes
exactly. Mm-hmm. So when I got a little jib arm when I was 18, when you would mount that to the tripod, it would mimic the same tilt and pan angle as the tripod, which means that no matter, even if the camera was on the end of a jib, it would still be a little off because it would match. It would be parallel with that angle.
Right.
So we have experimented a lot over the years with getting different tripods. I think our first one was a Davison Sanford that we bought officially. That was when I think Ben and I were in New York at the B&H Photo Video Store looking at tripods, and that one caught our eye as one that was reasonably priced because they're super expensive.
Such an interesting story.
It was $100. Yeah, that's interesting. And that will probably be another discussion is about brick and mortar stores for filmmaking gear, which would be interesting. But yeah, I think if I recall correctly, I believe it was like $125, $130 or so.
Very reasonable. And it seemed good quality looking at it, but I think the main problem we ran into is the legs wouldn't lock.
Yeah.
They would slide.
Yeah, in my experience, and you know, luckily with my job at a camera rental company, I get a lot of exposure to all kinds of gear at all varying levels of quality, if you will. Like, you know, I deal with stuff that's the simpler stuff for small cameras all the way up to the kind of tripod heads that will cost you about $30,000 for film cameras. And one thing I can definitely say I've come across is really in this industry, a lot of the time you really do get what you pay for. And with that first tripod, you know, we did not have a lot of money to play with, and that's what we could afford. And so, you know, we got it and we made it work for us, but we paid $135 or whatever for a tripod and we got $135 tripod.
And I don't think it was a fluid head either, or was it?
It was a fluid head in pan only.
Mm.
So, which then was a real challenge for us because at that time we were doing a lot of event filming and made for panning and like following a presenter in a pan mm-hmm. was fine. But as soon as we had to tilt, it was a whole thing because it would rather...
I remember that now.
Another thing with the fluid is because it allows for some variable pressure on the spin.
Yeah.
Whereas with a normal lockdown, there's various styles, but like, you know, it's just sandwiching a plate.
Right.
Like so you don't really have a whole lot of control as how much on or off.
And anytime we had to change the tilt, it would be very noticeable from the camera perspective. I think that was the main issue with
that. Yeah, it was. It really was.
I didn't notice that until like you mentioned that now. That's interesting. Having you want fluid with both tilt and pan.
You do. Yeah.
So we're going to talk about one and then touch on a different tripod. But the main one we want to highlight is the Benro S6. That is a tripod that's going for $299 right now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the step below the one we currently own, which we'll talk about as well. But this one's a great introductory tripod because
absolutely.
It can go up to 70 inches. It can load, have a max load of 13.2 pounds. And it's made of aluminum. And what's the head like on this one?
You mean it's a fluid head?
Yeah.
Yeah, this one, it's a fluid pan and tilt, which mm-hmm. is great.
And does it have like things like counterbalance? You can adjust like the resistance.
Yes. Yeah. You get all those. You get a really nice set of those controls. You know, depending on your camera. You know, that's another thing. Is like people like, for example, the Ursa, Blackmagic Ursa camera. Everyone was raving about that when that camera came out.
Yeah.
But the reality was the body alone of that camera is like 16 pounds, and you know, and that means, you know, as soon as you start getting up into needing that much weight, the price of a tripod skyrockets.
So what kind of things can happen if you overload a tripod?
If you overload a tripod, like if it's way too heavy, then it will just start breaking things. Like, you know, obviously if you put a 60-pound camera on a tripod that can only hold 15, it's going to start breaking things physically. But like, you know, if you say like this tripod is, what was the weight on this one?
13.2
pounds. Say you put on a camera that is 14 pounds, it might eke by and work, but then you're putting a lot of wear and tear on things like the fluid head, mm-hmm. The resistance mechanisms and the counterbalances.
Sure.
It's more than it's designed to account for. And that's another thing when you look at tripods, if your camera weighs 10 pounds, you should not find a 10-pound tripod.
Mm-hmm. It's all the other stuff you're going to put on.
Yeah, that's part of it. And the other thing is, just because the tripod head can deal with that much weight, does not mean it works ideally when you have it to the max.
Sure.
You know, just like with your car can technically go to 120 miles an hour, but for the average person's car, it's probably not great for the car to go that fast.
Okay, sure, that makes sense.
So, you know, if you're looking for one, you probably want to be aiming for one that's, I would say, about 5 pounds or so more than what your camera setup weighs. Mm-hmm. Because again, as Ben said, that accounts for if you're going to put a monitor on it and microphones and video transmitters and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And, you know, it looks like a very durable design. It looks pretty much the same as ours as far as design.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing, just scaled down for a little less weight.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, it's got an average of 4.5 stars, which is good for... And B&H reviews are pretty reliable,
I think. Yeah, no, yeah, I've found them to be quite useful. The other thing to look at with this tripod is the leg material. Wade mentioned that they're made out of aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
Aluminum is a nice material. It's relatively lightweight and relatively strong, and as a result, that's why this tripod is, you know, $300 or so. You can probably find another listing for this same head, the S6 head, with carbon fiber sticks.
Mm-hmm.
That will probably add like $100 or $200 onto the price to go to carbon fiber. But, you know, this one will work great. Like if you're doing like event filming or you're doing a lot of like lock off on location or sorry on set filming, this one would work fine. But as soon as you want to go out to location and you need to then deal with having to carry stuff everywhere,
yeah.
A lot of times I would highly recommend in trying to get the carbon fiber version of it. And that's what we have with ours, because we knew we were going to be trucking that thing all over the place.
Yeah, and just to touch on a couple more of the features that it has. So it does have a counterbalance system, which is great for if you want to have the tilt ready and not locked off, ready to tilt it at a moment's notice, and mm-hmm. you want to let it go and not have the camera just flop forward and just fall mm-hmm. off the tripod or whatever. Mm-hmm. The counterbalance system has 4 settings of 0 pounds, 4.4, 9.9, and up to 13.2 pounds. It also has the adjustable leg angles. You know, so it can have its default setting. But yeah, then you can like click something in near the top and the legs expand even further and you can lower the tripod even more.
Yep, and that's also really useful with this kind of tripod when you don't have a floor spreader. Some tripods mm-hmm. have a floor spreader, so it's like, you know, a three-pointed star, if you will, that the bottom of each leg attaches to, which is useful, again, if you're in a studio and locked off. But again, if you want to go in the field, you need something that will hold the legs at a specific angle.
Yeah.
So they don't just kick out.
Right. To that point of stability, it also has a center hook column underneath, so you can add weight to that and add more stability. It also has the light up bubble.
Oh,
the
level bubble. Yeah. That's a really key one that often goes overlooked, is remember to level the head.
Yep. And, you know, a whole bunch of smaller little features that are great to have. It also, you know, comes with a great heavy duty strap case. Well, actually, ours snapped.
Ours may have snapped.
I don't know how heavy duty it is. We'll touch on that in the next section. But that is a great one to start off with. Highly recommended. If you can afford a little bit more, the one that we bought is the Benro S8. And that goes for $649 right now. And it can hold up to 17.6 pounds. It has a 63.8 maximum height, so a little bit less than the 70 inches of the other one. But this one does have carbon fiber sticks, which are incredibly light. I was very impressed by them when I first picked it up.
And this one has held up very well. I think we've had this one for about 3 years
now.
About 3 years. And really the only thing that has gone on with this one is I think one of the clips that hold the extension legs got a little loose. And so we basically just had to take a wrench out and tighten down one nut.
Which, you know, isn't that hard to do.
No,
and it's designed to be able to do that.
Yep. And it's held up very well. And as I said, you know, we were looking at it for the weight. We wanted one that had a bit higher of a weight rating because, you know, moving forward, you know, as camera technology changes so quickly, it's hard to say what camera you will be using in the future and what new ones will come out. So we wanted to make sure that we were planning somewhat for the future. We were looking for something that we could use the camera we currently had and then also other cameras that we could rent or borrow or other cameras we may purchase in the future.
Right. It also says that it comes with a deluxe carrying case, a soft case that holds the tripod, which is the one we have. So maybe it's different from the heavy duty one listed for the S6.
Yeah.
One can only guess. Yeah, because the S6 says heavy duty case and strap. So, you know. Ours.
Marketing jargon.
I mean, the case isn't bad. It's an okay case.
It holds the tripod.
Right.
It does its job.
So we talked about the fluid head. We talked about the counterbalance, the importance of getting sticks that can go at different angles. Mm-hmm. What are some of the benefits you get for going up like super expensive, like the thousands of dollars worth of tripods?
When you're going up to that, you get several things out of it. One of them is obviously a difference in quality. If say the Davis and Sanford one we got, I'd be willing to take a bet that there's a fair amount of the internal parts, the parts that you can't see, were probably plastic.
Sure.
A lot of cheaper tripods, a lot of the internals are plastic, like the way some of the gears work and some of the brake systems to lock down the tripod are probably plastic. When you get up to these ones that you are spending thousands, if not tens of thousands of dollars on, a lot of times you're getting those internal materials begin to be, you know, aluminum, steel, that kind of thing. So they're a lot more robust and they'll last a lot longer. And then I have some tripod heads at work that, again, are designed for big, huge film cameras that probably cost you about $30,000 for. And we've had them and they're probably about 35 years old.
Wow.
And, you know, you wouldn't know other than some of the dents and dings on the outside, but it still works brilliantly.
And their load capacity is probably
higher. Yeah, with some of those, I think you could probably get away with putting about 100 pounds on top of them and you wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah.
You also get a lot of adjustability. I should say a greater extent of adjustability. You know, like that this Benro one we were looking at, we talked about the counterbalance. It has, you know, you just have 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4. You know, and that's all you get in those specific ranges. On some of the nice high-end ones, there's actually a crank and a scale.
Oh, interesting.
So you get from 0% to 100%.
Gotcha.
And everything in between. So you're not stuck to those four. You can you want to fine-tune it and go to 66%. You're all set to go. Also, another thing is with these tripods, most modern video tripods have a quick release plate of some kind. It's a plate you mount to your camera, then you can easily slide the camera on and off very quickly. And you do get a little bit of play with that, where you can slide the camera back and forth as a way to help balance it if you have a longer lens on it or if you have another monitor, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. With a lot of these bigger tripods, just because they're also physically bigger, there you often use dovetail plates or something along those lines that are these plates that you may get 12 inches of play.
Oh, wow.
That you can move around to help balance out whatever you're putting, whatever kind of camera setup you're putting on it.
And again, couldn't recommend this tripod brand enough. I haven't used the S6, but the S8, having used that, I love it.
Yep.
I don't see any downsides for using that one at all.
No, and it's great. And it is great for the price too. Again, as I said, you really do get what you paid for. And I think we've gotten great value out of this one system. And, you know, they're not as expensive as some other brands like Sackler and Manfrotto's, but I think they're on par for their capabilities. And I have used the S6 head a little bit, and I'd say it's the same quality and usability as the S8. It's just a little bit smaller.
Gotcha. Well, we could talk about tripods all day, I'm sure. So we're going to move on here, and in the next section, the tricks of the trade, talk about durability of equipment and protecting it. Be right back. So guys, having gear that can stand the test of time and protecting your gear couldn't be overstated. So we're going to talk about some of our personal examples and some of the items and tools we've used to do this. One of the main things that comes to mind is obviously, you know, getting a tripod that can hold up. We talked about that. But also, what are you going to put the tripod in? A good case to help protect it. We don't have one of those, but one of those would be nice. When I was in film school at MCTC, we used to haul around these Sockler sticks in this giant... it was like the hardest plastic you can imagine.
A tough pack,
yeah,
is what that would be.
Okay,
that
kind of and it was brand. It was heavy, but you could just throw that thing around and it would be fine.
Yeah, that's the kind of case. It's a tough pack. TUFFPAK, I believe is how it's on. The long, skinny, often rolling cases, and that's what we use all the time when people are traveling on airplanes. Mm. They put their tripods in them, and they're very strong.
Yeah. So, what do you guys think? Do you think like is the preference to get cases and you know, protective items for your gear to where you can get to the point where you can just chuck it around, or should it be a little mix of both? Like, be respectful with your gear, but still get the expensive, you know, nice cases just in case.
I think it kind of depends on what you're going to be doing. You know, I feel like if you're going to be going off and doing hiking videos all the time, you want something that's going to be a little bit more rugged, because you're not going to be able to bring it around in the case all the time. It's just too damn heavy, too big to schlep around. So you're going to want something a little bit more
schlep.
That was the thing. Do you remember that from college? That's what Wes, one of our professors, would always say. Oh. You have to schlep your gear around, and it's always the best when you can find someone else to schlep your gear
I never picked that one up. Before we were recording, Ben, you were bringing up Casey Neistat and how he just chucks his gear all around the place.
Threw it on the ground.
Yeah, and God, someone in the comments of one of his videos was like, "Well, that just is his way of showing what gear is durable and what gear isn't going to stand the test of time." It's like, oh, can I just take my MacBook and chuck it out the window? It didn't stand up to my rigorous lifestyle.
Well, one of his videos, I think maybe two or something back, like, he showed all of the cameras that I think he was reviewing the A7, and he showed the cameras that he used for the previous year of his vlogging. Mm-hmm. And I think he went through about like 8 or 9, I think 60s, whatever he's using. But he like
70, I believe.
He showed like 8 or 9 boxes up on his shelf that he went through. Like, what?
It's insanity.
Yeah, and for most of us, we do not have that luxury.
No.
We do not have that, you know, that income that allows us to go through that many. So protecting the gear is important. One of the things that we had delayed for a long time, for very soon, but we did finally get, is we got a custom cut Pelican for our Blackmagic 4K production camera.
Yeah.
Pelican is one of my favorite brands for those kinds of cases. If you don't know what a Pelican case is, it's a incredibly strong plastic, hard plastic case. There's another brand as well called SKB.
And I don't know if I've seen those before. How is it different?
They're a little... The one thing is the plastic. This is a really weird thing, but the plastic is very, very smooth.
Okay.
On SKBs, whereas Pelicans then have... They're almost like... They're still smooth, but they have that roughish texture to them.
Easier to grip.
Yeah, I personally like Pelicans more. They are more expensive. Mm-hmm. I think their plastic, for one, tends to be a little bit thicker. And while SKB claims to meet almost the exact same requirements as far as fall damage and waterproofness and whatnot, the Pelicans just seem a little more robust to me.
Yeah.
The other nice thing with both SKB now and Pelican is they have like lifetime warranties. As far as I know, like, no questions asked lifetime warranties. Like, we've had cases where the latches have just snapped off. We sent the case and they send us back with a new latch.
Wow.
That's it.
That's nice.
So it's great. So like, so while a Pelican can be expensive, and, you know, to get one to fit your camera set, your camera rig in it, could probably put you back a couple $100s. You know, it's a couple $100s that you'll probably be using. You know, it'll be worth that money. Like, you'll probably not have to replace that.
Do they make cases that are easier to carry around? Because that, like, that Pelican case is substantial.
Yeah, well, that's actually a pretty small one is the one we have.
Interesting.
They don't make like ones that are like molded for your backpack, really. They have a special line called Pelican Air, which are special ones that are designed to be lighter, mm-hmm. a bit thinner on the thickness of the walls, but still, again, maintaining the same quality and drop tests and water and underwater water resistance and waterproof testing. But they're really designed for people who fly on airplanes.
Mm-hmm. I will say, if you think Pelican cases are a pain to lug around, just check out the film equipment cases that existed before Pelican.
Yep.
And they weren't plastic. Like the lens case ran out at Cinequips. They were like that, but bigger and a pain in the ass. Like, so there's this lens case and it's maybe 12 inches by 12 inches.
Yeah. They're about 14 by 14.
Okay. Or so. And you know, it's got a metallic shell. And it's very awkward and heavy to carry because you kind of have to just like lean while you're carrying it. Mm. So it doesn't smack your legs as you're walking.
Yep.
And I remember like the case for the Airy SR would be a big cumbersome, just like pain in the ass thing to lug around.
Yeah, we would call a case like that, though it's a brand name, but like Kleenex, Anvil cases.
Okay.
Is what
they felt like carrying around an Anvil.
Yeah, and so they tend to be, all the edges and corners are all capped with metal. So the running like the whole edge is kept with like an L bracket of metal, and then there's the corners have big metal knobs on the end of those.
Yep.
And then some of them are also metal on sort of the box shape, if you will. Some of them are hardened plastic. Some of them are plastic and then a layer of wood on the inside. Hmm. And those ones are really robust. And one thing to also look at when you're looking at some of these different cases, like do I get a Pelican or an SKB or an Anvil, is are you going to be flying? Is a huge thing. Because if you're going to be local, if you will, like you're maybe doing some driving or a lot of driving, but you're really going to be in a certain region and not flying that much, you can get away with a smaller case. Like if you're doing a foam cut inside. But if you're going to fly with something, then you need to like double the foam thickness.
And is that just to compensate for airline workers chucking your stuff around?
Yep. Yeah. So, you know, if you're going to carry it on the plane, then you're usually fine with a smaller case. But if it's like you need to be able to check something in, then you need to like 3 to 4 inches of foam on every side of everything in the case.
Yeah,
to protect
you. You can slap as many fragile stickers as you want. They're just going to chuck it.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
But I will just stepping back real quick to our camera situation. Yeah, for I think at least a few months, we didn't have the Pelican case.
Yeah.
And instead, we just had, I think, like...
Was it just the box that
No, we had the Ryobi.
Yeah.
Like,
it was drill bag. It was my power drill carrying case, which is not...
Just a little soft bag.
Not what you want to carry a $3,000 camera around in. Luckily
nothing happened.
Yeah, seriously. now we have that nice Pelican with you know, really nicely cut foam to protect it. And the thing about Pelican cases is they're pretty versatile. You can use it for basically anything.
Yeah.
Of that size.
Yeah. And really also if we, depending on, like, as I mentioned, we got ours with custom foam. So we had somebody who does custom foam cutting and it did a custom insert for our case where it has a cutout that's specially designed for the camera. It has a cutout for lenses. It has a miscellaneous pouch where we can put some of the power cables and the wrenches and that in. Mm-hmm. Then it has some other custom cutouts for batteries and then some other ones for
the manual
rods.
Stuff.
Yeah, in the manual, thank you. And so with that, everything works nicely because also on the point of organization, it makes it very easy to tell when you're packing up what you're missing because everything has a space and if it's not in its space, it's missing.
That's a great point. And also, I forget what brand it is, but there's a certain foam you can get where it comes pre-perfed into grids.
Oh,
oh yeah. You're talking about pluck foam.
Yeah, and you can remove sections along this grid. Yeah, you can pluck pieces from this foam. And it's designed so you can custom cut, in quotes, your own foam.
Yep, and that's what a lot of cases come with that standard.
But I'm guessing based on your expression, it's not as good.
Well, we had one for our first camera.
We did. Yep. Yeah. Again, if you're in early on like that, that can work. But because it's scored in that way, it's, you know, as soon as if you put your camera off kilter and it catches that edge, then it starts to cut more foam out. Yeah. So it works in the short term, but I would always recommend getting custom cut foam. And there's places even online where you can go and they can you basically like take a picture of your layout of your gear and they just sort of make a pattern from that and then they like laser cut or water jet cut the foam and they can send you the insert that just pops into the case that you've picked out.
Is the case for our drone Pelican 2? It's not, is it?
No, that is an off-brand one, because that one was it was custom cut specifically. It already came custom cut for a Phantom drone.
Yeah.
And so like some people do that, where I think SKB even has it, where like they have pre-cut out ones. They're like, yes, this is our setup for like a 5D kit. Mm-hmm. And like we already have it cut out. So there's a slot for your camera and there's a slot for some lenses and your slot for the batteries, and it's all preset, which is great if the gear you have fits into that, into those boxes already, if you will. But if like, well, I have a bunch of custom stuff, like I have some base plates and I have different lenses or bigger lenses, then you need to go and probably do your own custom one.
Speaking of lenses, we haven't talked about lens covers yet, which is another good way to protect your gear.
And a highly, highly overlooked one.
Yeah, so walk us through this.
Lenses are expensive. This is a fact.
And get out of town.
Yeah, I know, right? You know the ones we were talking about, I think in episode one? Was it episode one I think we were talking about lenses, or episode two?
Episode four.
Yeah. For that reason? Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. when you purchase a lens, it is a long-term investment, really, because lenses hold their value really, really well, as long as they're not scratched or damaged. But as soon as they get scratched, then you have problems. Now, if you take a lens and you scratch the front element, so the front piece of glass at the very front of the lens, that gets scratched, more than likely, that whole front piece of glass has to be completely replaced, and it can cost you like a third or more of what you paid in the first place for your lens. Mm-hmm. So what people, and I don't know why more people don't do it, but they make like clear filters. So basically just a filter that, for a lot of lenses that have threaded fronts, it just screws onto the front and it's just a clear piece of glass.
Yeah, I've seen those. How much do they cost?
They can, depending on which one you're looking for, they can vary, but, and also the diameter, how big around it needs to be. So if I have a bigger lens, like an 82 millimeter filter, is going to put you back like $40 or $50, whereas one for a 52 millimeter will put you back like $25.
Okay, so comparing that to the cost of the lens, it's, you know,
it's nothing.
There's no reason not to do it.
And the other thing is, like with that one, so you have that at the front, it's a clear piece of glass. Some of them are like UV filters, which are technically clear, but they also help cut down some UV light. You know, with those ones, you drop your camera, it hits that, you shatter that clear filter. Oh no, I shattered that, I need to clean up some glass, but the front element of my $700 lens is fine.
Yeah.
And there's no cover for the back side of the back end of the lens. There's no cover for that one, because that one,
because in theory, the camera, in theory, it's either going to be connected to the camera or covered, have a plastic cover on it.
Yep. Yeah, in which you should always do. Like, I've seen some people who throw their lenses into bags without any caps on them. And yeah, that's just painful to think about.
Yeah, no good, no good. But then, finally, rain covers / element protection.
Yes.
Now, obviously, we know, you know, when you're shooting in the rain, you want to cover the camera, and they make custom jackets for that that form fit to different types. But what other kind of rain protection is good to have?
A plastic bag.
Plastic bags.
Yeah, in a pinch, that yes, absolutely. Like when we were filming Dawn Under Heaven, we were filming in the late fall. We're up in Minnesota. We could be hitting snow at any point in production. And so one thing that we did have in this pinch is we had, in one of our cars, we had a full box of trash bags. So at a moment's notice, we could pull those out and we could cover our cameras and our monitors and some of the lights we had immediately. But so, like some of the other custom bags, is like there's some special plastic bags called, I believe they're just called baguettes. They have various sizes of them, but they're designed to be pulled over the whole tripod and camera and tripod.
And the operator too?
Well, for some of them, they're big enough. Yeah, you could.
Wow.
And so sometimes those ones are used, like, you know, if it's just out in the elements, you just throw it on there when you're not filming, or you can cut a hole in the front of it to poke the lens through.
Right.
But also for other weather, they do make some custom jackets specifically for cold weather. Ones that are, you know, thicker, like a down jacket almost.
Yeah. Protected to help from wind.
Just to help it keep it at a normal operating temperature. There's a lot of cameras and lights. If you read the specific section of the manual about operating conditions, a lot of them say that they are not rated to operate below 32 degrees or freezing, 0 degrees Celsius. You know, in all honesty, most cameras do work below that and they work fine. You know, I've been out on shoots when we were at, I think, 8 degrees or so Fahrenheit, and we didn't have anything on the camera at the time and it was perfectly fine.
For how long, though?
About 5 hours.
Oh, wow. Yeah. One thing that I've wondered for a while is, if you're shooting in the rain, you can either you know, do like what you said, cover the whole camera, but you leave a little hole for the lens, or you cover the lens, try and protect the lens itself from rain. Is the idea to have a lens cover then, instead of trying to cover it with a plastic sheet or something to protect?
You mean the front element?
Yeah.
With that one, whenever you're dealing with rain with lens, it's always this, you know, it's always a thing, and artistically, if you want to see anything,
right,
hit the front.
Right.
So like the other thing is if you're using a matte box of some kind, and we should have talked about matte boxes in a future episode.
It works as like a hood.
Yep. You can help cut that off a little bit. But you do have to be mindful because as it's sticking out over the top of the lens, if rain collects there, you may see larger drips come down and not just the light rain.
Yeah,
so you should be mindful
of that. So it varies based situation to situation, basically.
Yep. And there's even another lens protector for rain that is really cool, but you can only use on MOS shoots.
It's the spinning one?
Yep. MOS being mit on sound or without sound. So ones where you're not worried about sound. You don't need to be worrying about dialogue.
Yeah.
It is called a spin tech, and you mount it on rails to the front of your camera, and it has a clear filter, but it's on a motor, so it spins at, I don't know, a couple hundred revolutions per second probably. And so if you splash any water at it, it's spinning so quickly, it flings the water out. So it pretty much remains dry and crystal clear the whole time.
And so the idea is that you can't even, it happens so fast, you don't even see the flinging.
Yep, exactly.
Because that would be kind of weird to be able to see the water fling off. Like
no,
that.
Yeah, it goes away so quickly, you don't even know that water hit it in the first place.
So I guess, to sum up, there's a whole host of gear you can buy to protect your filmmaking equipment, but also in general, you do get what you pay for with this kind of stuff. And we'll talk more in the future about things like microphones and lights and that sort of stuff. But you know, cameras, lenses, tripods, all this stuff, if you put your money's worth in, it lasts a long time.
And especially for some people who may be listening, this may be your livelihood. Mm-hmm. You know, you may be trying to make it in doing event filming or narrative or documentary. Protect your gear. It is what allows you to make money. So you should do everything you can to protect it.
Unless you're Casey Neistat.
Unless you're Casey
then
Neistat.
Then just do whatever the hell you want.
Yeah.
Yep.
So moving forward, in the next segment, we're going to talk about Denzel Washington's new film, Fences. Well, I guess not so new anymore because it's been in theaters for 2 months, but we will break that down. So, Fences, if you haven't seen the trailer for it, I highly recommend just looking at that and seeing if this film
piques your interest.
Yeah, piques your interest. I saw it on like an autoplaying Facebook video back in November or something. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking that that's a really well done trailer because it doesn't really give away much, but it gives you a sense about what the film is going to deal with an address. It is currently, it's pretty high right now in Rotten Tomatoes, right? I can't remember the exact score.
Yeah, Ben's
going to look that up.
Yeah, look at that and see what that is.
Right back. Let's do bets. I think it's going to be 94.
86.
Ben, what do you think?
He's looking
I'm
at
looking,
it.
No, I'm not, I don't have it quite yet. I'm going to guess 90. Or did you say 86?
I said 86.
Are you going to play?
I'm going to say 87.
86.1. Price is Right.
That's not Price is Right.
Well, anyway, this is based off of a play.
Mm-hmm. A stage play.
A stage play, I believe, of the same name.
Yes.
That Denzel Washington was also in.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
No, mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yep. James Earl Jones did it as well.
Yeah, that's cool.
That would
Ben, what do you got?
The same role. 95.
Oh, I was off by one.
Wow.
Y'all
that's
can
way
suck
better
it
than I thought it was going to be.
The audience score is 80, though.
Well, that doesn't matter. Nah, I only want critics.
Yeah, we need critics.
But, God, it was about a little over two hours.
Yep.
And it reminded me initially, in the beginning, of 12 Angry Men, but only because that's the only other movie I've seen based on a play. Mm. You guys seen that one?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes. That's a classic.
It is a classic. And I guess the only other film that this reminded me of was Lincoln, because that was...
It's been a long time since
Lincoln is a lot like a stage play, I guess, in that it's mostly just dialogue scenes between the actors.
Well, and you, I think you said it right. This movie, when I was watching it, screamed stage to me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Me too. The cinematography, the blocking,
yes,
everything was like there were so many wide shots where you would see whole people in the space, and at times very few close-ups.
Yeah, and actually to that point, one of the first things I noticed, and that is brilliant because this is what you absolutely have to do when you're adapting a stage play to the film, is take that stage direction, that blocking, and make it work in a way where you are trying to make the camera feel like a member of the audience of the stage play. Yep. So, mm-hmm. For example, in one of the earlier scenes, you know, you've got Denzel and then his best friend character and then his wife in the backyard on the stoop kind of talking with each other. Mm-hmm. They're talking, they're kind of getting up, walking, changing position, and just kind of generally just mixing themselves up in the space compositionally. They move the camera. I didn't really move the camera, but they use the camera in such a way where I think they were perfectly mimicking what my eyes would be doing if I was watching it on a stage.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed that also stood out for me in any monologue that anybody had is that's when I really noticed the close-ups.
Yeah.
Was in a monologue, because just like an audience member, if someone's monologuing, your attention all focuses to who's giving that monologue. Absolutely. It doesn't matter if there's other people there,
yeah.
But it's all about the monologue.
Well, I think even the fact that there were monologues, I feel like most of the times in movies, there aren't very many monologues at all. And there are so many in this one where you just have a character who goes on, rambles, talking. Yeah. Like Denzel's character does.
Yeah, and, right. And you also see it with their locations. Because really, in the greater scheme of things, there's two locations. Mm-hmm. There's the backyard, and then there's
the house.
The kitchen, dining room, yeah, in the house. You know, every once in a while they go to another at another spot, but that's really all they are.
Yeah.
Much like in a stage play, and, you know, a lot of plays, they don't, you know, unless they're really huge, extravagant ones, they don't have a lot of scene changes
and
location changes.
This film kept reminding me of the first movie we talked about on episode one of the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. Do you guys remember what it was?
It was a movie that wasn't in theaters. It was an old one. I feel bad
here
now.
Here we go. Ben's looking it up.
It's not
Inglourious Bastards.
We're talking about Inglourious Bastards. Yeah.
And it reminds me of the scene in the bar.
Mm,
the bar, sure. The scene in the bar, I believe, plays a lot like a play. Maybe not in the cinematography necessarily, but I think in the dialogue and how the tension is slowly ratcheted up across that 20-minute long scene.
Yeah.
This film did a lot of the same stuff and I believe was very it didn't like ratchet up suspense, but it was effective in that it kept me paying attention because I did not know where it was going to go. Sure. You don't know where a scene's going to end up when people are just chatting in the backyard. Yeah,
there was a lot of this too. I mean, especially with character transitions too, characters entering and exiting felt a lot like stage, where you have some conversation between the two. One person leaves and that person continues to do something, and all of a sudden another person just kind of comes in.
A lot of the entrance and exits felt like a stage play, where there's the one location for the scene and then people would just come and
exit stage, right?
Hey Corey, go into the house, grab this thing, and then they would exit and then the scene would play out. A lot of focus on one specific set piece and the comings and goings of characters there within. Mm-hmm. It felt good to see a show like that, I guess,
because
it felt different because we don't get a lot of that in the cinema.
And the other thing I enjoyed, I was very happy. I was very happy we picked this to see, because drama films are not something that I seek out a lot of times. There needs to be something really big to draw me into it. I think the last drama film I intentionally went to that was not something that we had done for a podcast would probably have been like The King's Speech.
Okay.
Would be the last like drama.
2011, I believe.
Oh, it wasn't that long ago, was it?
Yeah, it was. I saw it my last semester at Augsburg, which was 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
No, it's not that old.
Yeah,
Ben, look it up and prove me right. It's 2012.
$5?
$5.
I
think right now you're at a...
What was it?
The King's Speech.
Yeah, which year?
He said 2011.
Spring of 2011.
What did he say? 2012.
David? It's 2010. You're both wrong.
Oh, snap!
Really?
What?
Yeah, 95 on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
Wow, okay. Well, alrighty then.
That's striking.
Another interesting with dramas that I also find interesting overall in Hollywood is a lot of dramas usually are well received by critics. They're well done. They have a great cast, great acting, great script, and the audiences that do see them like them a lot.
Yeah,
but not many people see them.
It's very striking. Yeah, because I think. And I believe a large part of that is marketing.
Yeah.
Because think about the big Hollywood blockbusters like Captain America Civil War or something like that. It's marketed so much. It's on the front page of YouTube. It's got ads in the Super Bowl. You see them everywhere. And if not for the marketing offenses, I probably wouldn't have wanted to see it. And the marketing was an autoplaying video on my Facebook feed.
Yeah.
Otherwise, and then I probably wouldn't have known about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that's because the dramas aren't necessarily very happy in all the time? I mean, I feel like a lot of people just like want to go to see a movie to be entertained.
Happy. I guess, but it's like a balance. Like the women behind me in the theaters that during the credits, they were like, I liked it, but the next movie we see better be a comedy to lighten it up. I think it's it's moderation. I could deal with seeing a few dramas if I balance it out a bit.
And I also think like one thing that we do every year is we do an Oscar watch party. And it's interesting how many of the films are ones that, again, not many people see.
Yeah.
Like they're critically acclaimed, everyone loves them, but I feel like a lot of people haven't seen them because a lot of them are dramas.
I wonder, moving forward in the next 10 years or so, if that's going to be cause a schism between wider media consuming audiences and Hollywood as a culture. Because think about films like Birdman and La La Land and The Artist, these self-referencing films that glorify and romanticize Hollywood and just kind of make commentary on that tend to win awards. And I wonder if that's because Hollywood just loves itself so much, they connect more with that, as opposed to wider media consuming audiences who watch YouTube videos, who are on Twitch. You know, they're not as plugged into that culture.
Yeah, sure. I also wonder though if we're going to see a shift because obviously it was a lot of studios that they care about their bottom line and how much money they're going to make on something, because you know we have seen over the course of the last 10 years how it's all started to be the same recycled stuff over and over that is going to just make the most money. You know, we're seeing superhero films are the top hot button item, and so we're going to see a lot of them.
Oh God.
And I wonder, but the other thing that's been climbing is high production value television, whether it be on HBO or on Netflix or and Amazon. Yeah. And I wonder if we're going to see some of these, because it seems that on TV, people are more okay with drama regularly.
Absolutely. Think of like House of Cards. It's not a happy show.
No. And so I wonder if we're going to see Hollywood is going to start making these ones that are designed to bring in billions.
Mm-hmm.
And less of these drama films as some of those ideas and themes and elements go to TV.
When I think about it, when you think about the business of Hollywood, your chances on return for movies like action movies, big Hollywood blockbusters from Marvel, your chances of return are pretty great. Whereas like a drama, you're hoping that it's going to sit well. And it's easier with Fences because Fences is already a known title for the most part.
Absolutely. Stage. Can you quick look up on Box Office Mojo? I just want to know what the budget of it was, and also what its box office.
I was also struck by when the credit, this surprised me every time I see a show like this, but you know, when the credits roll and the cast, credits come up, it was very short.
Right.
It was
yeah.
maybe a dozen at most people in this film, as opposed to, just normal films that the cast scroll goes on for at least a while.
Yeah.
And then you've got the special effects one that goes even longer.
Yeah. And also before Ben reads the budget stuff, another thing to keep in mind when you're looking up the budget and then box office of a film, keep in mind that a rule of thumb you can run off of is whatever the budget is, you take about 75% of it and add it on to account for a marketing budget. Now, for a film like Fences, it's probably a lot lower of a marketing budget than like Captain America.
Mm-hmm.
But keep that in mind when you're looking at like, so if a movie cost $100 million to make, you know, you should probably think it's probably like $175 million includes marketing. So if they don't make $175 million in box office, then they're at a loss.
Yeah. Ben, what do you got?
So the production budget was $24 million.
Wow! Isn't that incredible?
That is nothing. That's pennies.
That's refreshing to me.
That is very refreshing.
I enjoy that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is there numbers for revenue?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. 51 million. 51.7.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'm really glad that a film like that can make its money back. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then some.
Absolutely. And also going off with this, you know, one thing that amazed me with that they made for $25 million and they have someone like
Denzel Washington
and Viola Davis. And I got to say, Viola Davis, the last few years
is amazing.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. She has been phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I need more of her.
Yeah.
She is a wonderful actress.
Very, very, very good in this film.
So I have a question that I want to talk to you guys about going back to the movie. Do you feel like there was an arc in it? What was the arc?
Yeah. Here's the thing. When did this play come out? Do you guys know?
A long time ago. I mean, if James Earl Jones was...
When did it come out?
Sure.
The
play. Look up the play for us, because I do want to know that. So what I was thinking, asking myself that very question, is that I think plays specifically, I've seen quite a few with my time at the Guthrie, they don't follow your typical Hollywood screenplay arc.
No.
And I do like that. I think plays in general, compared to films with the Hollywood structure, they have a more morally ambiguous way of storytelling.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting and uncomfortable in some instances. The women behind me, sorry for the spoilers, the women behind me said it during the credits, I never expected Denzel to cheat on his wife. Never saw that coming.
Well, but it's interesting because they really were setting that up from the very first conversation.
Yep.
Touched on that, and it set that seed.
What was said specifically?
It was between him and his I would think his best friend,
buying the number of Bono. Drinks. The number of drinks you buy for a girl.
Oh. They were talking, but they were also saying, you know, Bono was talking about, hey, I see you going over to this other place sometimes, and it sort of, he puts it off. Denzel's character puts it off, and it's in a way that I caught on very quickly. Like,
yeah.
Bono's trying to giving him crap over sneaking around, and he's brushing it off, but it's because there's something to that.
Yeah. You know, I actually missed the first 10 minutes of the film, so I missed that part.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Yeah.
Which is what when the part came when his friend brought him over to the alley, which is a really great shot, by the way.
Yeah.
So it's when Corey, the son, goes inside to look for a saw, and Bono is his name, the friend?
Yeah.
Yep.
It's all done in one wide. He kind of gestures, you know, jerks his head, and you know, they walk over to the alley, and it takes, you know, maybe 20 seconds of them to walk over there and stand, and it's... You can feel something's kind of percolating to the surface here. And I did enjoy that a lot. Also, I feel like, in general, the acting in films like this, and this one specifically, is very genuine and feels very visceral.
Right.
As opposed to any other typical Hollywood film.
Yeah.
Because they're so conversational.
Mm-hmm.
It's so dialogue heavy and not very, obviously,
like
being
life.
A play. Yeah. Where... A lot of times it's people sitting around talking about something for 20 minutes and they shift topics. They shift like modes and rhythm and in how they're talking with each other, and people are coming and going and stuff. And it's nice. It's a nice way to see a film once in a while.
I think it was refreshing how small it felt. When I feel like when you go see movies, they end up being so grand and so expansive, whereas this, literally, even the things that they're talking about are relatively small compared to their inner circle for work or whatever.
It's very much a character piece because the things they talk about are something that literally you can find anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. People having the same conversation about where is the money coming from, disagreements between children and parents, that kind of thing. But I want to jump real quick back to Ben's comment about the arc.
Yeah.
I think in some ways the arc I was personally following was The Fence. Arc, because that mirrored the drama that was happening, and you can see what the stages that The Fence were in or not in reflected the part in the story.
Yeah.
Early on, as this thing is starting to catch up steam, The Fence is not built yet, and then they're slowly building it, and then, you know, by the end, after things have come out with this affair, this child, this fence has come up, and the movie is called Fences, the play is called Fences, it's about the fences, physical and emotional relationship fences we build. And, you know, they make a comment about fences not only keep things out but keep things in, then they separate us. And I think, you know, by the time the fences come up at the end, that fence is also between Denzel Washington and his wife. Is where another fence has been created.
Absolutely.
They did stay together, but they were not together, I would say.
What do you guys think about the climax, which I guess was the confrontation between the father and the son, and how it kind of left you in a weird state, I guess, when it ended and then cut to black for 10 seconds.
So I think it was interesting beforehand. You have Denzel's character remarking upon the story of his own father and how he had his fight with his father. And he said that he described his father had like the devil in him or whatever, like that. Mm-hmm. And I think during that confrontation with his son, with Denzel's son, I think there's a point in time where either one of the two says that Denzel's character has a devil in him, and literally they had a scruffle and the kid's leaving. It's the same exact thing that he had with his dad, which I thought was very interesting.
I think a big theme this film deals with is the idea of your the following generations dealing with abuse and trying to leave that abuse behind and be better than their father was.
Mm-hmm.
You have Denzel trying to be better than his father was to him, who sounded like a savage individual, and the kids trying to be better than their father was. And it's a really nice moment at the end of the three of them kind of bonding with each other.
Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite parts of the movie was when Denzel's character tells his wife that he's going to have the kid.
Yeah.
When they start, and Denzel's character starts going on about all the stuff that he's been going through. And there's this point of realization where, I guess he doesn't realize it, but his wife mentions, like, I've been here this entire time too. Yeah. It's like, it's interesting because the whole entire play, it's dominated by Denzel's character's voice, his conversation, him talking about himself and his own personal struggles. And as an audience member, that's what you're focusing on too, because that's what you're presented with.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden she speaks up really loudly, really forcefully, reminding everybody that she's, even though she is a supporting character, she has all the same needs and wants that your main character that you're focusing on does as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and just, you know, pushes it down because she puts her family's needs first. And in for all the preaching that Denzel's character does about the responsibilities and sacrifices he's made, he falls short. Like, and he really never deals with that. He never has his redemptive moment in the film with that. I mean, granted, he, you know, doesn't try and give away or pawn off the child. He takes the child home, but, you know, saying, "Oh, I'd appreciate it if you took care of my baby." It's like, you know, he I didn't see any effort on his character's part to like try and make things right. And he talks the whole movie about you got to do right by X.
And it's also interesting that with that is we're left that towards the end is that moment of bringing the baby back. And then again, what would be normal for a theater goer who has seen much theater, but probably different for an audience here, is then the next thing you know, he's dead. I think a spoiler alert. Sorry. Yeah. But I mean, like, and the whole last about 10 minutes of the film, 10, 15 minutes is, and it doesn't go into really much of his life in the 6 odd years or so that had been since his death.
That's sort of
since the last section left off.
That sort of indirect way of dealing with that very important moment is felt very Coen Brothers to me.
Mm.
Like in the end of No Country for Old Men, when you have like the main character dies off screen in a fight we don't see. Like that felt very Coen to me, which I didn't have a problem with necessarily, especially since plays tend to do things very differently from films.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's why I said, like, I think, you know, a theater goer would recognize, and that would be a normal trope, would be these jumps in time as a play is wrapped up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ben, did you look up when the play comes out?
1983.
Oh, that's much more recent than I thought.
That is more recent. I would have expected to be in the 70s.
Yeah. Well, what do you guys think about, you know, I personally would like to see more films as plays come out. You know, you see so many books being made into films. Mm-hmm. I think I'd like to see more of this sort of thing.
I think if it's done well, I think that Fences was exceptionally done. An exceptional transition from stage to
definitely
film.
Definitely done well, and I would like to see more following that example. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you can screw it up.
Yeah, as we talked about, it seemed to transition very intentionally from the stage to the silver screen. Mm-hmm. Like, again, how the filming was, the blocking, the locations they used. I want to make sure that there are some that will take advantage of the screen and what more you can do, because you're not confined to a you know, a 30 by 40 foot stage and the scenes you have built. But without going overboard, like, it doesn't need to go like full movie.
Yeah.
Well, one thing that this did do was, I think, it right around where the intermission would be, there was a montage after the first fight when his son threw the football helmet at him.
Yeah, that felt strange to have that.
Yeah, to me that felt like. I looked at my, like, oh, it's been an hour. It's intermission.
Oh,
and then so they had this montage and whatnot. And so I think that was useful, because again, you can't have a montage really on stage that I'm aware of anyway.
Yeah.
What this felt like was stage coming to the screen versus a theater story coming to the screen.
Mm.
But I think to your point, David, they have done that at least more recently, and I haven't seen the movie, but the Scottish play recently came out with Fassbender.
Yeah, well, that's Shakespeare for you.
Yeah.
But the Scottish play is a Shakespeare play. I won't say the actual name of it. It's not called the Scottish play. You won't find
it.
But if you look up Michael Fassbender Shakespeare, you should find the actual name of that play, which I won't say aloud.
Why?
Theater superstition.
Yes.
Oh.
About it.
You're so weird.
Yeah.
So, what would you guys give this film?
Out of 10?
Yeah, out of 10.
Wade, what would you give it?
I think for me, this film was an 8.5 out of 10.
I think I'm going to be along with that. I think Denzel played Denzel well. But I'm the supporting actress's name. What was her name?
Viola Davis.
I thought she was extraordinary. Just great.
Absolutely wonderful.
Like a chameleon. Like, she felt like it was very different.
Yep. And I would give it a 8 as well.
An 8? Yep. Ben, what do you give it?
He said an 8.5.
Wow.
He's with you. So right on the same point.
I want to say 9, but...
Well, then say 9. Everyone was super quiet when I asked, and now since I said my rating, 8.5.
Yeah,
I do like that. It's got a good score on Rotten Tomatoes, but again, that's not in that's what an aggregate.
It's not actually a
Metacritic.
I want to see it again. I want to more critically go through it, kind of study some of the filming that's done, because a lot of it's done on sticks, but there are some choice moments where they go handheld.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is pretty interesting.
Also, one thing that stood out to me was the bar, because anytime there's a scene, a period piece in a bar, I'm looking for how the production team cut corners, because obviously they have to use a bar that exists.
Yep.
And bars, unless you gut it, which no business owner is going to let you gut their bar unless you build your own.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at the things behind the bar and seeing if it's period. This took place in the 50s, right? 56 is what the letter jacket said. On Corey?
Yeah,
so it would have been.
So there were, behind the bar, I noticed everything behind the bar, there was one of those soda guns, which I don't know if, did those exist in the 50s?
I don't know. I feel like they might have.
There's also a beer bottle cooler that was directly in front of Denzel and his friend. That looks exactly like the one that I used when I bartended.
They didn't teach you the history of bartending when you were in bartending school?
Not, I wasn't in bartending school.
Oh, never mind. There is that though.
It was just interesting looking for the period pieces that weren't necessarily of that time. Anyway, I guess just to wrap up, really enjoyed it. I'm glad I could see it in the theater. Oh, I forgot to bring this up. I did notice a couple weird digital zooms. I know it was shot on film, but there was a few shots, and it was during the shot reverse shot medium close ups on people when they were talking, specifically on Bono when. They were having the moment talking about the affair. The first, the shots on him were digitally zoomed.
Okay.
And I definitely noticed it. I didn't catch that.
On
a theater screen. It was night and day. Because it will go back to a wide, beautiful film shot and then digital zoom. I'm just like, what is this? This looks like a daily or some unfinished shot.
Fix it in post, man. Yeah. Fix it in post.
It's nominated for 4 Oscars.
Which ones?
Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yep.
Best Picture. Best Actor and Best Supporting Actress. So best actor for Denzel Washington, and then Best Supporting Actress is Viola Davis.
Which awards do you think it's going to win, if any?
I don't think it's going to win Best Picture, but I think that Best Supporting Actress is probably going to go to her.
Yeah, I would say I think it would be Best Supporting Actress, and I think it probably has a fair chance of getting Best Adapted Screenplay.
I was going to say those two as well. Mm-hmm. Those two as well. So it's still in some theaters. If you haven't seen it, I would recommend checking it out if you can.
Absolutely.
It's kind of hard to find still, but you can do it.
Yeah.
But also with that, it's probably in the next few months going to be coming out to iTunes and Blu-ray and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So you probably can catch it in a few months if you can't find it in theaters. Or you can look for a second run theater. We'll probably be starting to get it right now.
Well, thanks for joining me, fellas, for this discussion today. And thank you for listening to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. We will be back next time with another episode.